All right, we're studying the book of Daniel, the first chapter and about the last four or five chapters are focused a great deal on what's happening with Israel, especially in the end time. The middle chapters talk more about the Gentile nations and the preparation for the end time, and so we're sort of in a preparational place here. We're studying the third chapter. Last week, I failed to bring the microphones. So if you go looking for last week's lesson on the internet, you won't find it. But I did teach this once before, and it's recorded. And so he's going to try to substitute the second lesson from the previous one. All right, Daniel 3:1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, its width was 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king went sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, counselors, treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, all the rulers of the province to come to the dedication of the image Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Now, remember last time Nebuchadnezzar had a bad dream, and he wanted to know what it meant, and so he brought in all the wise men and the magi and the Chaldeans to explain to him what the dream meant. The problem was, is he wasn't going to tell them what the dream was. He was no dummy. And he says, if you guys can figure out what it means, you can figure out what it was. They said, well, nobody's ever done that before. He said, well, I just didn't get here last night. So that's what he required. He was going to have them all executed until Daniel heard about it. Daniel and his friends were all caught up in this group of wise men, mostly in training at this point. But because they were in the group, they were getting ready to become beheaded for it. And Daniel said, give us some time, we'll seek the Lord. The Lord will give the answer to the dream. So that happened, and Daniel came in, and he told Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was. And then he explained it to him, or as you'd say, he explained it to him, as Lucy said. But what happened is the dream was that there was this giant statue, and that the statue had four component parts, as it were. The head was made out of gold, and the shoulders and down to the waist or so was made out of silver. The waist and the belly and the thighs were made out of bronze, and then the legs and the feet were made out of iron. And then the feet themselves were a composite of iron and clay and represented a later version of the earlier kingdom. There was going to be two pieces, as it were, to that kingdom. Daniel explains to him that these are four great Gentile nations that are going to rule until the time of the Messiah, and that the first nation was Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold. And once Nebuchadnezzar heard head of gold, I don't think he heard anything else, because he said, I'm the head of gold, you know. He was really good about that, really big on it. The silver kingdom were the Medes and the Persians. The bronze kingdom were the Greeks, the Macedonian Greeks under Alexander, and the final kingdom of iron was the Romans, with the secondary part of it, or the tail end part of it, being the Romans of the end times, the same Roman community, the same Roman peoples reconfigured in the end times. And we'll get into more detail about that as we go, partially because as we go along, Daniel will give us the explanation. The thing about Daniel is even though he's apocalyptic, he tends to explain his terms more than some of the others do. So we don't have to guess as much with him. He wasn't near as much threat and danger, and so his writing is a little easier to trace down. His images are easier to understand. What happened is that this head of gold, this statue with this great head of gold on it, caught Nebuchadnezzar's imagination. And so this week, it's like almost soap opera, he's got a new idea for this statue. And the idea is that he's going to build this statue. It's going to be an enormous statue. I think it's about 90 feet tall. And he's going to have people bow down to this statue as a representation of him as the Lord. Let's see here what it says. I think it told us how big it was. 60 cubits. That's a cubit is the distance from your wrist to your elbow, commonly known as 18 inches. So if you don't have an 18-inch wrist distance, you are substandard. So it's 60 cubits, and then the width and everything is there. So he has decided that everybody's going to bow down to his statue. come hell or high water. You remember, he's a guy who kind of wants it his way. He's had a problem with that. Then the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, and judges, and the magistrates, all rulers of the provinces, were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, and all the peoples and the nations, the men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that the king had set up. All right, so we have this big statue, and everybody's got to bow down, and if they don't, they're going to get thrown into this furnace. Now, first, let's talk a little bit about the furnace. I wonder how many of you have ever seen a movie called The Last Brickmaker in America. It's on the Hallmark Channel. It's a great movie. It's got, it stars Sidney Poitier as an aging black man who makes bricks the old-fashioned way, the way he was taught to make them, where they bake them in the clay and they sit them out in the sun and then they put them in the furnace. Have y'all ever seen this movie? It's on the Hallmark Channel. You ought to grab it up, get it on your Netflix. It's a really nice, good, solid, decent movie, and it's sort of it's historically accurate. The deal is they show you how bricks in the old-fashioned system were made. And they gather the clay and they mix the sand and all that together and they put them in these molds, just like you would imagine, get them all squared out, and then they take them and they set them down and they spread them out over for miles, for a long, long, long way. They set them out to let them dry to a certain place. Then once they dry to a certain place, they build a brick room. With the bricks all stacked in a certain way, with openings and everything like that, and a big roof on it, and that is a brick kiln. That's how you dry bricks. That's a brick furnace. So the furnace that we're talking about tossing these people in is not, you know, like when you were some of you all remember the old big old furnaces with the forced air and everything like that, where you could almost get a body in them. It's not like that. This thing is a room. It's a room maybe this size. Which has been built out of bricks. There's these huge fires that are built inside of them, and the temperatures are measured and kept at a certain level for a long period of time in order to make the bricks solid, and the openings in the bricks are controlled in order to keep the temperatures right where they are. So if you ever get a chance to see this movie, you'll get a really good idea of what Daniel's furnace was like, the brick furnace that he's talking about in here. So what happens is that these guys are told that if you don't bow down, that you'll be thrown in the middle of this furnace. And this furnace is quite hot. And that was the penalty for failing to bow down. Now, for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward, and they brought charges against the Jews. One of the things that's happened during this time frame is because Daniel's been successful at interpreting the dream, he has been promoted, and of course he took his homies with him, his friends. They're now in a good place of authority as well, and it's generated no little amount of jealousy, as you can imagine. The people have been around forever and ever. The Chaldeans are the cream of the crop of the Persian Empire. They're the people who are most known for their wisdom and their all that sort of thing. And here are these upstart Jewish kids with high squeaky voices are now ruling over them, and they don't like that a whole lot. So there's some jealousy here, and you're going to get several sets of stories about these people trying to get Daniel, his friends, killed. One of the reasons that we are given some of these stories here is to help us to see the character of the men that we're dealing with, from whom these prophecies are going to come, and the way that God works with them in the midst of their difficulties. They're compared or comparable to Joseph, and the way that he related to God in the midst of his slavery, in the midst of his very difficult situation, his unfair situation, how he trusted the Lord when it was been easy for him to do otherwise, and how God rewarded him with insight and wisdom well beyond his years and well beyond his experience. So much so that Joseph, as you remember, becomes number two in all of Egypt and winds up becoming basically the second most important, powerful man in the world at that time, as he gets people in the world through the famine that comes at that particular time. Well, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are cut out of the same cloth. So the Chaldeans come forward and they bring charges against the Jews. And they responded and they said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, psaltery, the bagpipe, all kinds of music is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. My Shack, your Shack, and Winnebago. That's how I remember these guys. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. So this looks like a good opportunity to take these men out because they will not bow down. Remember, they've already agreed to die or go to prison in lieu of having to eat the foods that they're not supposed to eat, and God has sustained them in that. They've said so. They've already stood up to the culture a couple of times, and in the face of the odds, and the Lord has helped them with that and caused them to be successful. Well, once again, here's another opportunity to get them, and we'll see how it goes. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar was one of the most ruthless and evil men of ancient history by historical record. This is not a biblical truth. This is a historically demonstrated truth. The kinds of things that Nebuchadnezzar did to people when he captured them are unspeakable. A lot of these guys down through history are pretty bad, and all of them are bad enough to be bad. But he was particularly ruthless. We already started talking about the fact that all these young men were made eunuchs as soon as they were brought into his oversight, so that he could have better control over them and use them in his purposes and whatever. But that's the kind of the light of it. He is a mean man. This is a lineal predecessor or antecedent of Saddam Hussein, who makes Saddam Hussein look like a choir boy. And so in the same way that Saddam Hussein and his sons were known for their wickedness and evil, they got it honest. They were not doing anything that had not been done in their culture for all of these years. And so Nebuchadnezzar was upset when it was brought to his attention that someone was not going to bow down for him. Let's see here. So he was in rage and anger. He gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, all kinds of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you will not worship, you will immediately be cast in the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? What God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? These people in the ancient world are often used by God, some of these despots, for his purposes. He uses Assyria, for instance, to haul off the northern empire. And he uses Babylon to haul off the southern empire. He uses Egypt to punish Israel at times. And God does use evil empires. In fact, one of the prophets said, Lord, the people that you're bringing to punish us are worse than we are in spades. And he says, yeah, but they don't have the light that you do. So they're my purposes. Isaiah says that God raises up and puts down whoever he wants. He uses whoever he wants. You get the government you deserve. Think about that for a little while. And that we are... That we need to understand that it is God. In fact, if you remember that one of the ministries of the prophet Ezekiel was to convince Israel they should not rebel against the captivity. Ezekiel was a prophet who lived in the captivity. He wasn't. Isaiah was before the captivity and was killed sometime right before he got started. Jeremiah overlapped it. But Ezekiel was a priest who lived in the captivity, and his job was to convince people to stop trying to go back to Israel. So if you read Ezekiel, that's what he's telling them a lot. This punishment that's come upon you is from God. You need to accept this. Quit trying to build your counter-revolutionary measures and all this kind of stuff. That is not what God wants. It won't get you anywhere. You just accept it, and God will deal with you and restore you in due season once the season's over. So God uses these people, and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego have fallen into the hands of a ruthless man, but the ruthless man's in the hand of God. And that's what they're counting on. That's what Joseph was counting on. So he says to them, if you don't do this, you'll be thrown into the furnace. And what God is there that can protect you? There was a guy named Rabshakeh. Rabshakeh is actually a kind of a title, like a general of an army. But he's called Rabshakeh in about 13th chapter of Isaiah, somewhere in Isaiah. And he comes to Jerusalem at the time when Hezekiah is the king. Hezekiah has been a very good king. He's been a very godly king. Hezekiah was, you have these four kings in a row there. There's Uzziah, Joram, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. They're all in a row. Uzziah dies in 742, and then his son Joram takes over. Joram is an okay sort of a guy, but his son Ahaz is really, really bad. Ahaz was Hezekiah's father. You can kind of see it in the names, Hezekiah, Ahaz, are spelled with the HZ kind of thing, but you can see it there. And the deal was is that these kings all had tons and tons of sons and children, and there's always this problem of people jockeying for the throne. There's all of that to be dealt with. And kings are too busy to, you know, they don't take them to Little League. You know, they're not coaching their teams. They're not doing this sort of thing. And what happens is these sons, if they have any sense at all, are given over to stewards for the purpose of them being raised and taught and trained, mentors, as it were. And someone is chosen who has the ability to make something out of them. And usually it's a member of the royal family who's not in the line anywhere, someone who's older and wiser and whatever. Well, this king, Ahaz, Ahaz, the evil king, he has a cousin, and the cousin's name is Isaiah, son of Amos. And Isaiah is assigned the job of raising Hezekiah as his mentor. So when Hezekiah comes to the throne, instead of behaving like his father Ahaz does, he behaves very, very well toward the Lord and does a pretty good job. Well, up comes Syria to capture Jerusalem at one particular point in time. And Rabshakeh comes up, and he is making a big spectacle of himself outside the gates of Syria. The people are all locked in. All the people are on the walls watching out, and he's very loudly announcing through his heralds that he has come to haul them off into captivity, and he'll make them a deal if they'll just surrender peacefully. He'll actually leave them alone for a while he goes and mops up Egypt, and then he'll come back, and he'll get them, and he'll take them over there, and they won't like it, but it'll be better than if they resist him. And he makes the point of saying to them, you know, all the other gods that we've faced have caved into our gods. Our gods are better than that. And our gods have actually given us all of your other cities. And so, obviously, our gods are stronger than your gods. Big mistake. So what happens is that God moves. God tells Isaiah to tell Hezekiah to withstand the guy, to resist the guy, and he does. And God moves and winds up just demolishing the army of Assyria in upon themselves. They wind up, these armies are often made up of mercenary groups, I guess we would call them. People, you know, when you're the Assyrians and you're the big people, you don't serve in your armies. You hire all the other people to serve in your armies. You conquer people and you put their soldiers in your army. So what happens is these armies are made up of all these subgroups, and sometimes they don't get along real well. And what God does is he goes down in the midst of them one night, gets them into a big old drunken brawl, and they wind up killing each other, about 185,000 of each other. And when the generals come back to it the next day and realize that they've got this major desecration or major destruction going on here, they haul it back to Assyria, and all of it comes to naught. So it's not a good thing or a smart thing to tell God that your God is stronger than he is, or to tell God's people that their God cannot save you. So he says to them, you know, I'm going to throw you in the furnace, and what God is there among you who can save us, can save you from my hands? But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king and said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of the blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. These young men have some pretty decent understanding here. They know, first of all, that God is on their side, that God will bless them. But they don't have any guarantees that he's going to spare them from all difficulty. Because difficulty is part of life. Difficulty is, Jesus said, while you're in the world, you will have tribulation. Be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. He didn't say, I'm going to take you out of trouble. Trouble is promised to us. It is part of the muscle building process in which we grow. Some of it is the result of the evil that is done around us, and it happens. So they said, you know, it's possible that God won't sustain us. It's possible. And if he doesn't, we will serve him anyway. We will not bow down to you. But we believe our God will sustain us in this particular situation. Now, these guys are friends of Daniel. They are what I call FOD. They are people who have been are part of his Bible study. They're part of his journey group. They're in his Emmaus fourth day group. And so they have been learning to live in faith and captivity for some time now. So they told Nebuchadnezzar that they must worship God, not man. They exercised the conscience clause. Now, remember that the Bible tells us over and over again, it has the nasty habit of telling us, that we're supposed to submit to all authority. And that doesn't sound like a lot of fun, especially when you think the authority is a jerk of some kind or another. And yet the Bible tells us that that is the case. Now, in Israel, for instance, at the time of Christ, the authority in Israel, the religious authority, was the Sanhedrin. There were 70 men who were chosen, supposedly by God, but that was a long time ago, to be the head over all of Israel, and they had the authority over all of the people about in matters concerning religion. And in Israel, which was a theocratic state, all things were matters concerning religion. You remember Paul said that five times he was beaten at the hand of the Jews. 39 lashes he received, and that was because the head of his synagogue told him that he had offended enough that he was going to receive these lashes. Paul submitted to that five times, in spite of the fact that he was not guilty of anything that he should receive it for. Jesus spoke to the authorities and resisted the authorities at some level, but he submitted to their crucifixion. He submitted to their processes, and we are. He tells the people. He said, you know, submit to them at the level that of the things they rule, but submit to God about other things. And he said, by the way, while you're at it, submit to Caesar on the taxes. So he was told that. Paul tells us in Romans 13, 1 Corinthians, that we're supposed to submit to the authorities. Now, there's a story in the second chapter of Acts, third chapter of Acts, somewhere in there, fourth, right in there, where Peter and John are going into the temple, and they run across a guy who's been lame from birth. And he's got a good spot by the gate there. He's been begging alms there forever. And he holds up his bowl for some almsgiving. And Peter says, you know, we're a little short right now. We don't need cash on us. Silver and gold have we none, but such as we have, give I thee. In the name of Jesus Christ, rise up and walk. You all sang that when you were in Sunday school as kids. So they've been walking and leaping and praising God. You've sung it a million times. So that's what happened. And so when that happened, he starts bouncing around all over the courtyard, and people who've known him for years and know that he's been lame from birth see that this miraculous thing has happened. They come charging around and start asking Peter, what's going on? How did this happen? And Peter gives his usual sermon. Peter has one sermon. He gives it every time. It's the same sermon. And it's a real doozy. Peter's sermon is, you killed the Messiah, but it's okay because you were stupid. That is the theme of Peter's sermon, and I know if our pastor would get up and share that with us, we'd all appreciate him, give him a raise. But that's exactly what Peter's sermon is. You killed the Messiah, but it's okay. You didn't know what you were doing. You were just dumb, that's all. In spite of the fact, as he mentions, there are about 87 prophecies that should have told you so-and-so. Actually, Matthew lists 159. But he said that's his sermon. So the people obviously liked that sermon, and they fell down and they accepted God in their heart, and the church grew, and the Sanhedrin didn't like it. So they arrest Peter and John, and they drag him up before their courts, and they tell them that they must stop preaching in the name of Jesus. Now, the Sanhedrin is the legal authority over these gentlemen, and therefore they are supposed to obey them. But like all situations where you're supposed to obey legal authority, you're not required to obey them if what they're asking you to do is immoral, illegal, or ungodly. What you can do is what they call, you can exercise what's called the conscience clause. You can say, I submit to you, as a ruling body, and I will take whatever punishment you dish out, but my conscience will not allow me to obey this particular command of yours. So you do what you think is right, because I have to do what I think is right. And that's what Peter and James said to the Sanhedrin. Well, they didn't know exactly what to do about this. They were thinking about, well, should we kill them or, you know, whatever it is. And they put them out to discuss it. And the wisest man among them, whose name was Gamaliel, who was the leading rabbi of his time, and who was son of his father was a great rabbi of note. And he was at there at the particular point in time. He was Paul's teacher. He was the teacher of all the best rabbis. And he says to the Sanhedrin at this particular point in time, you know, we get from time to time these messianic people that rise up and they claim to be the Messiah. It is a big hubbub. And he said, but if we leave them alone, what happens is that pretty soon their whole thing caves in. It dissipates. People go their own way. And it's not a big deal. And when we go out and try to make a big martyr out of them, we just extend the problem, make it bigger. And he said, the best thing to do is just leave these boys alone, let them go, because it'll come to nothing. Because he said, if it's from God, it will be found resisting him. We don't want to do that. But if it's not from God, it'll come to nothing. And his wisdom carries the day. He lets them go. And what happens is they've demonstrated for us the conscience clause. And that's what these young men are doing. Remember, they're in a foreign country. They're slaves. They have a requirement from God to obey their masters. In fact, you got Ezekiel preaching to them. They should not be resisting in any sort of a subterranean way. They shouldn't be part of some sort of a paramilitary group that are trying to bust out and all that sort of thing. Ezekiel is telling them that they should submit to the captivity because it's from God. And they are all part of that particular group, and they're saying, we would submit to you, O king, except that what you're commanding us to do is something God does not permit us to do. What James and John said was, is whether or not it's right for us to obey you or God, you have to decide. But as far as we're concerned, we can do nothing more than what we've been told to do by God, which is preach in the name of Jesus. Now you have at it, whatever it is you think is good. And they did the same thing. They said, you know what, we're pretty sure that our God will deliver us from this, but if he doesn't, we still can't bow down. Even if it means that we're going to lose it all, pay the ultimate price, we cannot bow down. So they trust God to deliver them, and they believe that the Lord will do that, and they praise and worship only Yahweh, refuse to bow down to the statue. All right, let me stop for a minute because I have a tendency to get to rolling and see if there's comments or questions or rebuttals or anything anybody wants to. My she who must be obeyed tells me I need to slow down. So. No. Well, somebody says it's like time to take a drink from a fire hose. But anyway. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. His facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Now, if you ever see this movie, you'll understand how this is done. Because what they'll do is they create a draft that runs from one side to the other, and it just causes the heat to jump up on this thing. I love this movie because of this whole image here. Because whenever I'm teaching, I always like to find a movie or something that people have seen that sort of relates to it. But it's great. You ought to see it because you can make this... This temperature, when they're fixing these bricks, they've got to maintain a temperature within a certain range and maintain it for like 3 weeks. And this is during days and nights both. So they're up all night, you know, keeping the temperature within range. And like if there's a rainfall or something, then they've got to get it way up. And if the temperature drops, they've got to get it way up. And so they're adjusting this temperature almost like they had a thermostat on it by corners and stuff. And that's what these guys are doing. So he says, we're going to heat this thing up 7 times more than it's usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them in the furnace of blazing fire. And these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their cups, and their other clothes and were cast in the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, the way this would work is that this furnace, which is like a brick building, You would approach it from a dirt mount on the sides. And so they would walk up to the top and they would throw them down into this thing. Well, the radiant heat was so strong that the guys who took them up there were consumed in the process of throwing them down. That's hot. So let's see. These three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they fell in the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded, and he stood up in haste, and he responded, and he said to his high officials, Was it not three men who we cast bound into the midst of fire? And they answered and said to the king, Certainly, O king. And he said, Look, I see four men loosed, walking about in the midst of fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. So what happened is they get thrown in, and all of a sudden their bonds are consumed. The only thing these guys lose in the furnace is their bonds. And they're joined by an angel, the Lord. You can have an opinion as to who this is. But they're joined by God or an angel in the midst of this fire, and they're sort of walking around worshiping, just sort of having a good time. Hey, Amy. Having a good time. So the king is amazed because he was not expecting this. He was expecting a quick puddle and then, whatever. And then everybody was going to be quickly bowing down before the statue. Another good movie that I love along these lines is Raiders of the Lost Ark. You remember Raiders of the Lost Ark? You remember toward the last scene when he and Karen Allen are tied up around a post and they're getting ready to open up the Ark of the Covenant? You know, the Bible says that you're not supposed to look into the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, you're not even supposed to touch it. And that the penalty for it is death. So what happened is they've got this scene, they've got Belloc, the French guy, and he's got this high priest garb on, and he's doing this high priest ritual thinking it's going to help him out, because even he's afraid to look in without doing the ritual on the thing. And you've got these German guys sitting around, you got the guy who's, with the burnt palm thing in his palm, and he's the evil, twisted guy, and you got the usual German soldier. There's one guy who plays a German officer in every movie that ever was, but you'll know him if you see him. So anyway, you got him there and a bunch of troops, and you've got Indiana Jones and Karen Allen, and they're tied up around a post, and they got blindfolds on. So what happens is that Belloc's doing this kind of stuff, and Indiana Jones, because he's a trained archaeologist and he's studied all this stuff, he understands all this, he's read this culture and whatever, because remember, earlier on he whips himself out a Bible and he shows the Ark of the Covenant and the light coming out from it and everything. Indiana Jones was a Bible scholar, but I'm sure you thought that was probably right. So he was in this movie. But so he tells Karen Allen, he says, don't look at it. He says, don't look at it. No matter what you do, don't look at it. Because the image of God's going to come out of this thing. And when he does, you do not want to look at God face to face. It will destroy you. Well, what happens is they open up the lid, and the lid goes way up in the sky, and out comes this angelic creature, and they're all going, it's beautiful, it's beautiful. And all of a sudden, it morphs into somebody worse than your mother-in-law's mother-in-law, and there they are. It's ugly, and they all start in terror looking at this thing. And before you know it, what do? They melt. They're evaporating. They're just watering down into nothing. And Karen Allen and Indiana Jones, he's still yelling at her, "Don't look at it! Don't look at it!" When it's all said and done, their bonds are burned off, and they're standing. They're all fine because they didn't look at it. See, there's these biblical principles that keep coming out here. So that's what he was expecting here. These guys are going to melt in the midst of the fire, but they didn't. And moreover, they've been joined in the furnace by some angelic being, someone who looks like the son of the gods in this particular place. So instead of being saved from the difficulty, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are saved in the difficulty. Now, this has a way of breeding confidence in you, because when you get yourself in these kinds of trouble and problems, and you're just sure, for sure a goner, and God meets you as you trusted Him that He would, it gives you courage that you're not only can count on Him, but that He is a friend. I remember what we're all trying to become more than anything else is a friend of God. The number one goal in the life of any Christian person is to become a friend of God. And that's, the Bible says that Abraham believed God. He was counted him as righteousness. And he was known as a friend of God. The Bible says that Jacob was a friend of God, that Joseph was a friend of God. And that's what we're trying to be as well. And that's where these guys are now. It says here in Isaiah 43, "Thus says the Lord, your Creator, O Jacob, and He who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name, and you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they will not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be scorched, nor will the flame burn you." In John 16:33, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take courage, because I have overcome the world." So God will deliver us sometimes from the furnace, but sometimes in the furnace. Some of you all in here know Barry Scott. Barry Scott's a friend of mine and a number of you all here who sit in the room. And his wife, Deborah, some of you all might know Deborah, and she had a brain bleed a couple of days ago at 1 o'clock, and they were quite concerned about it, but God has restored them, and they are going to be fine. It's not as bad. I don't know if you know the story there a lot, but it's pretty meaningful, given where all Barry's come from, especially with this whole thing with Deborah. Barry will tell you that he was an agnostic, an atheist, confirmed atheist, and Barry's an intellectual man. He's a thinker. And he was committed to his agnosticism, not his atheism. And about 5 years ago, Deborah got very, very ill, heart problems, I believe what it was. Very, very ill, and she was about ready to die. They told her she was not going to live. And Barry, who loves Deborah very, very much, anybody who knows him knows that, made a deal with God, just a straightforward deal. If you save her, I will give you my life. Now, this is a guy who doesn't believe in God, but he said, if you do that, I'll know you're there, and I will give you my life. Well, she got healed. And Barry's a man as good as his word. And so he started coming to church. He started going to classes. He started reading his Bible. And for all of the difficulty it is of trying to understand all of this, he pursued it and stayed with it because he had made a deal. A deal's a deal. And at this particular point in time, he has grown a great deal. And this particular incident demonstrates that because of his level of faith and whatever. Deborah was a believer for some many years. And so she was blessed by having her husband catch up to her where she was. But God has met them in the midst of all of this, and they know it. And they know now twice that God can move in their midst. And they have not only faith, but they have courage at this particular point in time. So we're very glad to what all is happening with them.
Wait.
Yes, please.
It says that the fourth person was Jesus.
Yeah.
How do we know that?
It's a speculation. It's just that it's a saving event. It's a salvation event. Let's put it this way. The consensus among biblical scholars is that it's Jesus. Now, Jesus appears in the Old Testament a number of times. It's called a Christophany. When God appears in the Old Testament, it's called a theophany, the appearance of God. The word phanos, or appearance, whatever, and theo. And when Jesus appears in the Old Testament, it's called a Christophany, and he does a number of times. One time, for instance, that we know it was him was when Melchizedek met Abraham coming back from the Battle of the Five Kings. And as he was coming back, he was bringing back all the booty and the spoil from having captured the mountain kings, mostly because they ran off with his nephew Lot, and he was really just trying to save his nephew Lot. So when on the way back, he winds up running into Melchizedek, who was both Prince of Peace and Prince of Righteousness. By the definition of his name, that's what his names meant. And he runs into Melchizedek, and they sit down and they have a supper together of bread and wine. And Abraham pays him a tithe. Now, whenever an angel or a spiritual being shows up in the Old Testament, the people in the Old Testament, first of all, they always go down on their face. Whenever there is any sort of a spiritual apparition, the first thing that any angel or any spiritual being says to people when they first meet them is, "Fear not," because the first thing they do is go down on their face. And when there are times when these people encounter these beings, that their natural reaction is to worship them. And when it's an angel, they will say, "Don't worship me, I'm not God." But when they allow worship, then you know it's God, because an angel would never allow himself to be worshipped, because that belongs to God. So there's these, well, there's all these various Christophanies and theophanies, and you can sort them through. Now, in the case of Melchizedek, the book of Hebrews tells us that it is Jesus, that Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. It tells us, for instance, that Melchizedek had neither father nor mother, that he had no genealogy whatsoever, and we're told that he was an appearance of God, as it were, in the Old Testament. You have another one you may remember is when Joshua gets ready to go over to Jordan after they've wandered through the desert for 40 years and Moses has died. They're getting ready to go over. And when the priests put their feet in the water of the Jordan, the water parts like it did for the Red Sea. And they start to go over, and all of a sudden this being appears, this spiritual being appears with a flaming sword and all the armor and everything on the other side. And Joshua says, "Are you for us or against us?" And the answer is, "I'm neither for you nor against you, but I'm the captain of the Lord's host." The captain of the Lord's host is a title that's for the second person of the Trinity. So that's another one that's there. Now, another appearance where there was an angel that was definitely not God was the story, you remember the story of Balaam's ass. Have you all know the story of Balaam's ass? Not too many, okay. Well, this is going to be long. I don't want to do this. At any rate.
Go there.
All right, I'll go there, but I'll try to be quick about it. When the people of Israel started moving into the Promised Land, it was the first thing they did was go into Jericho. And as you remember, what happened in Jericho wasn't pretty. And so the word got around pretty soon that the people who had fled 40 years earlier from Egypt under great miraculous circumstances, and who it was rumored had all this relationship with God, the God of the mountain, and et cetera, et cetera, had now entered the land, and the miraculous overthrow of Jericho caused these people to fear that, sure enough, these were the people, and they did have this kind of relationship. And so the locals began to try to figure out, how do you defeat this kind of an army? They tried several approaches, and they weren't doing too well. At one particular point in time, they gathered a bunch of guys together. Israel was mopping them up. There was not enough time to finish mopping them up. And so Moses and Aaron prayed, and God gave them 18 more hours of daylight so that they could finish the mop-up process. When those things happen, the word gets around, and you start thinking of different strategies for how you're going to deal with these folks. And so the king of Moab calls for a prophet named Balaam. Balaam was a man who was a prophet of God, but he had gone bad. The scripture says that the gifts and call of God are irrevocable. And if God gives you a gift, that whether you use it for good or for ill, the gift is yours, you will have the gift. For instance, and I don't mean this inappropriately, but Billy Graham said the most charismatic man he ever met in his life was Bill Clinton. And he said if Bill Clinton would have used his charismatic abilities to communicate with people for the sake of the ministry, that he'd be a better evangelist than Billy Graham was because of his charismatic gifting that he had, his ability to talk to people and convince them that that what he was saying was good. You know, you have the stories of Elmer Gantry. Some of you got a little age on you, you know Elmer Gantry. And the whole idea that you can have someone who's very, very gifted, but they turn it into something evil, like they'll use their gifting as a minister to become rich. We have a few of those people running around today. Or they use it to get women, or they use it to get power and whatever. So the gifting of God, gifts and call of God are irrevocable. One of the ways that you need to, the Bible tells us that you're supposed to check out whether or not somebody's a good guy or bad guy is not by looking at his gifts. You don't go saying, well, gee, the guy's very gifted, so he must be from God. Because a person's gifts can be used for good or ill. But rather by looking at his fruits. We're told that we're supposed to look at the fruits of the prophet, not the gifts of the prophet, to see whether or not they are from God. A good man will have the fruits of God, of the Holy Spirit. The bad man can still have the gifts. Well, Balaam was one of these guys. Balaam saw a way to make a good living doing prophetic work. And so they sent for him because he had a reputation for this. And they came to him and they said, the king of Moab wants you to come and curse Israel. When they come in to the area, we're going to put you up on a high mountain where you can see them from a distance. He wants you to curse them so that their God will be defeated. Remember, you got to remember that in the ancient world, there were lots of gods. People thought of there being lots of gods. And the truth is God didn't get real strict about talking about there being only one God until about the 8th century, until the prophets came along. I mean, he talked about it some. But what God described himself throughout the Old Testament as the Most High God, the God above all the other gods. And so when you read all of that, so people had a tendency to think that they got gods, these got gods, you know, our gods are better than their gods. And if our gods are not, then we need to do something about finding better gods. And so they called Balaam in. They said a group to Balaam to say, would you come and curse them? He said, who do you want me to curse? And he said, Israel. He said, I can't help you. And he said, no, you know, this is a lot of money in this. You need to come. He said, I cannot curse Israel. God won't let me curse Israel. And so, you know, they kept pressing him, and he said, well, let me ask God. And God said, you know, you don't want to do that. So he said, I can't help you out. And they said, look, it's a lot of money. He said, all right, let me ask him again. And God says, all right, go on up, but don't say anything I don't tell you to say. So Balaam gets on his donkey, and he is heading toward Moab. And he is walking through these mountainous passes, and he comes to this very, very narrow place, and the donkey refuses to move any further. And so what happens is that Balaam starts beating on the donkey. I mean, and after a while, the donkey turns around, looks at him, and says, why are you beating on me? He said, have I not always served you well? You know, have I ever let you down before? Why are you beating on me? And Balaam's going, this is weird. This is, huh?
He talked back, which is the funniest.
Yeah, well, yeah, he did. He got to arguing with the donkey. But he did. And the donkey said, look, you know, he said, I stopped because if I didn't, you'd be dead. Well, about that time, this angel morphs up in front of this gap. And the angel said, if that donkey hadn't stopped, I would have cut your head off with a sword. So at any rate, the angel and Balaam have a conversation. So then Balaam goes in to the thing. And when he gets ready to curse the people of Israel, he blesses them instead. Well, the king is real upset about that. So he said, this is what I paid you for. He said, I can't help it. So, you know what I got to say. So he says, well, let's go to another mountain. Maybe from another mountain you can curse them from over there. So they go to another place, and Balaam blesses them again. So Balaam's not doing too well. His employer's not real happy. And so we have this story. Balaam eventually figures out a way how to make a buck out of it. And he says, I can't curse them, but I can tell you how to destroy them. So what you need to do is to go down and intermingle and marry among them. And if you do, you will eventually lead them astray, and then you can overcome them. And that's what they do. And in the book of Hebrews, we're told about the evil that is Balaam and his advice on how he caused the sons of Israel to be destroyed by the intermingling of them with these other people when God had forbidden them to intermarry and all that other thing. He's talking about syncretism. But that's a story about an angel. In this particular case, the angel is not claiming to be God. So, does that answer your question? Okay, about 10 minutes ago, maybe? Okay. All right.
That's some good examples. That's what we really look for, is examples through the Old Testament.
Yeah. If you get yourself like a Bible dictionary or something and look up theophany or Christophany, I'm sure they'll probably list about 20 or 30 places. I mean, one place, for instance, where God shows up is when Abraham's having dinner, and this guy walks up with these two other men, and they sit down and have dinner. And in this particular case, God is looking like a human. You look like a human, but they pretty quick they realize it's not a human. But he's looking like one. He's taken on the form of one. That's a theophany, and we're told point blank, this is God, and these other two guys are angels, the ones they sit down into Sodom and Gomorrah. And we're told that Abraham decides to see if he can cut a deal with God over how many people it would take to save Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember that story? So there are these kinds of manifestations of God, either in spirit form or in human form in the Bible. Can I go on? Okay. So Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace blazing fire, and he responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God. See what he said? The Most High God. This is how the God of Israel was identified throughout the Old Testament, both by Israel and by non-Israelis, as the Most High God. It would separate him apart from the other gods. Come out, son of the Most High God. Come here, and come here, you servants of the Most High God. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the furnace, and the satraps, and the prefects, the governors, the king's high officials, gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their heads singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of the fire even come upon them. And Nebuchadnezzar sees with his own eyes the miraculous deliverance of the friends of Daniel. He calls upon them to come out. He examines them closely, and he finds no damage upon them. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angels and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God." Now, this is one of the most ruthless men in the world, and it's made an impression upon him. He said, these guys, they had enough courage to violate the king's command, and their God stuck up for them and stood with them, and blessed are they for that reason. Now, about this time, he might be remembering that the last time he dealt with some of these people, they were answering his dream. I don't know. It doesn't say that. But it's a pattern starting to develop, and we're going to see it again in a little bit. In another story here. Then, where am I here? It's therefore, he said, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. So this has made a real impression on him. Then the king called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. Now we're seeing a kind of a pattern here, and that is when these people try to harm the people of God, and the people of God trust them, that what happens is the people who are trying to harm them wind up getting penalized over the thing because of that. And so we see this happening again over and over in the scriptures here. So he publicly blesses and acknowledges Yahweh, as he had done before in the previous story. He prohibits any anti-Yahwistic behavior and speech throughout the realm. He blesses the friends of Daniel, causes them to rise in authority and finances within the kingdom, and the faithfulness in Daniel's friends is a marvelous witness even to the ruthless pagan and king. Okay? I'm moving through some of this because it's not directly related to our prophetic stuff. And you probably all, you all heard these stories before, right? You've been through this before. Comments here. Okay? What am I doing? What's this class? 6 to 7:30? Okay. Nebuchadnezzar, the king to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that live upon the earth, may your peace abound. And this is one of the most remarkable stories in the Bible. This is the story of Nebuchadnezzar the king bearing witness in writing to his conversion to Yahweh. When you go to heaven, you're going to see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you're going to see Abel. And you may not see some other people. I'm not any expert on who's not there. But there's some people there you may not expect to see. But one person you are going to see there is Nebuchadnezzar. And one of the things that's amazing about this story is that it goes to show that even the most wicked of people can become people of God under the right set of circumstances. So we've got Nebuchadnezzar, the king, writing a testimony, as it were, of his conversion to becoming a follower of Yahweh. May your peace abound, he says. I'm not sure that Nebuchadnezzar spent a lot of time in his previous proclamation saying, may you all abound in peace. Mostly it's, I will tear you in pieces, not may you abound in peace. It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders of the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream and it made me fearful. And these fantasies as I lay on my bed and visions in my mind kept alarming me. These fantasies, as I said, I think I already said that. So I gave orders to bring into my presence all the wise men of Babylon that may make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners came in, and I related the dream to them, but they could not make its interpretation known to me. But finally, Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belteshazzar. That's the name that they had given him as a as that Babylonian name, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I related the dream to him, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, since I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you, and no mystery baffles you, tell me the visions of my dream which I have seen, along with its interpretation. So he personally testifies to the glory of the Most High God. He's had another bad dream, and once again, Daniel comes in to help him out. Now these were the visions in my mind as I lay on my bed. I was looking, and behold, there was a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. And the tree grew large and became strong, and its height reached to the sky. And it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its foliage was beautiful, and its fruit abundant. And in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the sky dwelt in its branches, and all living creatures fed themselves from it. I was looking in the visions of my mind as I lay on my bed, and behold, an angelic watcher, a holy one, descended from heaven. And he shouted out and spoke as follows, Chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its foliage and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it, the birds from its branches, yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, with a band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. And let him who share with the beast in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let the beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. Now this phraseology here is important to us for our study, because this means 7 years. And in the language, that's what this means. And we're going to run into this again when we start talking about times, times and a half times, and whatever. So let 7 periods of time pass over him. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers. The decision is command of the holy ones in order that the living may know that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes. God gives his kingdom to who he will. It sets it over the lowliest of men. This is the dream which I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, tell me its interpretation. Inasmuch as none of the wise men of my kingdom is able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. So we have this, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and in this dream he is shown that he is going to become beast-like. And for 7 years he's going to wander in the fields like a beast. This is a known disease called boanthropy. It's a form of monomania, and if you've ever read the story of the madness of King George, King George had monomania. It's a mental disorder that's chemically induced, and people become animal-like and crazy, nuts. And in this particular case, he just goes out and wanders throughout the grass and the field. Yes, sir, you have a question?
Did the change from the tree as an object to him? Farther down there?
The great tree was...
Did you share with the beast?
Yeah, the great tree was Nebuchadnezzar. He was the... And all the birds of the air nested in him, and everybody covered under him. He was the big kahuna that was the blessing for everybody, and everybody depended upon him. And it was cut down, and that tree became Nebuchadnezzar, and he began to wander around mindlessly like this. Now, the story of King George and many other people who are not so famous who've had this is that there is a chemical imbalance of some kind, and they want to become imbecilic. And it comes, and then it goes. And so what happens is people are this way for a while, and then they come out of it, and they're fine again. And the problem with being a king when this happens is it puts you in a bad position to defend yourself or your kingdom. So one of the things that we'll see here is the only reason he has a kingdom left by the time he gets out of this 7 years later is because he's got good people around him who are protecting his kingdom. King George, you remember, had the same thing because others wanted to take him out because of his infirmity, but he managed to be restored over time. So this is what he is told is going to happen. Nebuchadnezzar is going to be cut to the ground and made to live like an animal in the field. Another guy who has symptoms of this that have been talked about a whole lot is Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes was a guy who had this madness that would come upon him, and he would become an absolute recluse is not the word for it. Some of his behaviors while he was often a recluse, but his behaviors while he was recluse were really bizarre. And some of y'all probably saw the movie The Aviator that spoke to that a whole lot, including the fact that he barely got out of it in time to save his empire because they were about to take it away from him, if you remember the story. So Nebuchadnezzar tells this story. He has this dream, and Daniel comes in and to give him the interpretation. He says, "This was done," Nebuchadnezzar says, "to demonstrate that Yahweh gives authorities to kings to bring them down at will, and God is sovereign over all the earth, over kings and other bosses." Now remember that the story of Daniel started early on, after we got Daniel into the story, with Nebuchadnezzar having a dream that there are going to be these four great empires that are going to exist from the time of Daniel until the coming of the Messiah. And at the time, at the end, in that fourth empire, the Messiah would come. And then there would be a break in that empire, and at the end of that break, the Messiah would come again. So you have this vision that we got in chapter 2 that was like that. So it's about empires. It's about empires and about kings. Nebuchadnezzar was also told that he was the head of gold, that his empire was the first great empire, followed by the other ones. And as we read, we'll see that it's very clear who they were. So we're getting this information here again that God raises up and sets down kings, that he uses kings and kingdoms for his purpose, and that he controls the times of men within the realm of our free will and our evil choices, but that he accomplishes his purposes. Isaiah, it says, God says that my word does not go out from me and return to me void without having accomplished what it purposes. What he means is that you can screw up the deal by all of your free will choices, and you do, and you will. But ultimately, I will accomplish my purposes anyway. God is like the supercomputer that can play the brightest chess players in the world and figure out how to beat them, even though they're making a decision about what moves they're going to make. That's the claim of his sovereignty. His sovereignty is not that he controls us like puppets. His sovereignty is that he will get his job done by using the variables and the permutations of our free will and accomplish it anyway. Basically what he's saying is I'm that smart. So in this particular case, he's going to use Nebuchadnezzar, and does use Nebuchadnezzar, but he's going to deal with him in this particular situation. Romans 13 says here...
With Nebuchadnezzar, if I can interrupt... With
please.
Nebuchadnezzar, righteous in any way at that point? It'd
be a relative term. Nebuchadnezzar is not some. Yeah, he's not. Nebuchadnezzar is not somebody who's going to become a choir boy, but he is going to behave better than he used to, and he's going to acknowledge God. He's got Daniel telling him what all he should do about things, and what you're going to see out of Nebuchadnezzar here is an absolute humility, an acknowledgement that God is God, and whatever. You got to remember, these people don't have the Holy Spirit. In the Old Testament, no one has the Holy Spirit. If the Holy Spirit comes on somebody in the Old Testament, it comes and leaves. It doesn't stay on them. And the behavior of people in the Old Testament is very often non-Christian. What a surprise. Christianity didn't come along for quite some time yet. When Jesus comes along, he raises the bar of standards all over the place. You know, the Old Testament is kind of like, if I can just keep from killing somebody, I'm all right. Jesus said, no, no, no. Not only can you not kill somebody, but you can't revile them either. And so he raises the bar. He changes the behavior. In the Old Testament, for instance, children are seen as tools. Old Testament people do not love their children, as a rule, like we do today. Our notions about children being precious are Judeo-Christian, but they're more Christian than Judeo. Now, I'll give you an example. Jacob has 12 sons. He has 10 employees and 2 he likes. He has one boy who doesn't have to go work like a slave all the time, who he trains and teaches. Now, in the Old Testament world, there is a principle called adoption. And Paul talks about that. He says, listen, you should be rejoicing at the fact that God loves you because he's adopted you. In our world, we think of adoption as a bit of second-class citizenship. You know, well, there were the children who were born in my family, and then those who I adopted. Now, if we have adopted children, we go out of the way to say, look, we purposely chose you, so don't feel second class. you know, and if your brothers and sisters are, you know, picking at you, but don't listen to them, because we love you. We assure them we love them. Ancient world was just the opposite. Men would have children by the droves, under every green tree, women all over the place, some wise, you know, whatever, children everywhere. But whether they were children of mistresses, girlfriends, temple prostitutes, because remember, all the ancient religions had a sexual component. If you wanted to worship, you went up to the temple prostitute, you gave her some money, and you had sex with her. The same thing was true with the men, because there was female temple prostitutes. That was, in fact, that was part of the problem in Corinth that Paul was having, was because of the worship of Astarte and all the things were going on. That was the problem in the Old Testament. The prophets were constantly saying, you're under every green tree worshiping the false gods. Children were so badly valued in this area that they would be sacrificing the firstborn to Moloch or some other god for the sake of prosperity. They were using them as chips and whatever. So you got Jacob, for instance, who big families were workers. People did that. You had Abraham, who absolutely loved his son Isaac. And the truth is, he was fond of Ishmael too. But he also has Keturah and 5, 6, 7 sons. He gives them some money and he sends them away. Adoption was the process of saying, this one is going to be my heir. This one here I adopt. This one is my son. Everybody else works for him. Now, if you look at what happened in Genesis chapter 50, 49, 50, right in there, when Jacob is dying, he sits down to determine who he's going to adopt. Well, the first person he comes to is Reuben, the firstborn. But he said, Reuben's disqualified because he had an affair with Bilhah, my mate. Reuben has been the firstborn. He's insecure. He's been trying to make sure he's going to get this job. And Jacob obviously loves Joseph. Joseph's maid is Bilhah, and so Reuben decides to have an affair with a much older Bilhah in order to try to control what goes on with Joseph. Doesn't work out. He gets caught. Simeon and Levi, he says, you're disqualified because you're bloodthirsty and you don't have the kind of wisdom it takes to run the tribe. You get us all killed. And how do I know that? Because we went down to Shechem. You entered into a false contract with these people, betrayed them, and all of the Canaanites wanted to kill us because of the way that you dealt with the people of Shechem. He said, you're bloody and you're bloodthirsty. Read it. When he gets to Reuben, to Judah, he says, Judah is the kind of guy I can use. I can't use Joseph because he's busy running the world. He can't do this. Judah is the guy that I'm going to use. Now, Judah's got an interesting story. Judah, as you remember, was the ringleader of selling Joseph into captivity. And he had a whole lot of guilt about all of that. And Judah left the tribe and went out and lived by himself. Unheard of. He left the security of the tribe, and he goes out and lives among the Canaanites. And while he's out there, he has three sons, darling boys, who all are slain by God because they're evil. And the first son he has is a guy whose name is Ur. And Ur marries this beautiful Canaanite girl named Tamar. And she's a beaut, but Ur's not such a good guy, and God strikes him dead. Well, he doesn't manage to give her a son in time, and so the Levirate law says that the second son, Onan, must now take her as his wife. And whoever, the son that comes from that union, the first son, is the son of Ur, and the inheritance of Ur goes to that son, and the lineage of Ur is continued. The Levirate law is used all over the Old Testament. It's kind of like surrogate parenting. Okay? It's done all the time. It's kind of what was going on a little bit with Hagar and Abraham. Well, so what happens is that Onan, he likes the deal. Tamar's a beaut, but he doesn't like the financial distribution. And so the Bible tells us he withdraws himself and spills his seed on the ground, whereupon God strikes him dead again. Now, the Catholic Church has made a whole doctrine out of this, that the reason you're not supposed to have birth control is because God struck him dead over spilling the seed. That's birth control. God doesn't like that because seed's precious. Let me tell you something. There's more male seed in this world than any other component, including iron. So the point is, there's nothing particularly precious about it. The reason God struck him dead is because he took a holy law and he used it for an unholy purpose. Well, what happens is that Tamar is still childless, and Judah has got another son coming along. His name is Selah. And Selah gets to be the marrying age, and Judah says, I don't think I'm going to give Selah to this Tamar, because I've already had two sons go, you know, belly up, and I'm sure it's her fault. I mean, you know, we, not my boys. And so what happens is that he refuses to give her. And so Tamar, who is trying to do what women of her age and culture are trying to do, which is have children, because that's the way you validate yourself in the ancient world, She decides if she can't skin the cat one way, she'll skin it another. So he's coming back from shearing sheep, and she dresses up like a Canaanite prostitute, meets him in the town, and lures him off into a place where they have sex, and then he goes to find money to pay her, and he's a little short. And so he gives her his staff and his signet ring and his cord, and says, "I'll be back tomorrow with a lamb, and you know we'll settle this up." Well, the next day he comes back, and she's not there. So he goes around looking for her. He can't find her. This is the 37th chapter of Genesis, folks. I'm not making this up. So he can't find her. And so he says to the people locally, "Where's the Canaanite hooker, the one that usually is by the well?" And they said, "We don't have any hookers by the well." And, you know, after a while it gets embarrassing, and he goes, you know, let her have the ring, you know. So he goes home. Well, about 2 months later, word comes to him, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, is pregnant." And he says, "That wench." That one might have said, but he said something like that. He said, "That evil wench, you know, she's evil, she's bad, she's been out having sex, she shouldn't be doing this, she's supposed to be my daughter-in-law, whatever, stone her." And so they go to get her to stone her, because after all, that's the right thing to do. And so while they're carrying her away, she gives the ring and the cord and the staff to the men who are dragging her off, and she says, "Go tell Judah that the guy who owns these is the guy who got me pregnant." So Judah looks at these things and he goes, "You know what? She's more righteous than I am." And Judah has an epiphany and he repents. Judah says, "I'm wrong. She's right." And so he brings her in and he says, "You're my daughter-in-law and you're precious and I'm wrong and you're right. I ask your forgiveness." And he says, and he puts her away. Nobody can touch her anymore. But he said, "I'm going to care for you and provide for you and whatever." And she has twins. And one of her sons is Perez, and Perez is the great-grandfather, King David. So this Canaanite woman who's not a Jew is in the lineage there. Well, Judah finally wises up, and he realizes that his sins have found him out. And so he goes home, and he makes it up with his father. He rejoins the tribe, and then throughout this whole thing that's going on, where they're going up to Egypt, and Joseph is playing games with their heads, and they're going back and forth, Judah's stepping up going, "Look, I'm at fault. I'm the guy. This is coming upon us because I sold my brother into slavery. You know, please don't take it out on my son, my brother Benjamin. Take it out on me. I'm at fault." When Jacob won't let him go up, he says, "You can have my sons. You know, if I fail, you can have my sons. You know, whatever." So he's being the man. Well, on Jacob's deathbed, he says, "I need a man to run the tribe. And Judah, you're the man." And so he gives him this big, long prophecy about how he's going to run the tribe of Israel and how that the seed of Judah is going to come forward to be the Messiah, that the scepter will not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes, until the Messiah reigns. Judah is adopted. Out of those 12, he's adopted. This process of adoption in the ancient world was, men did not adopt their children when they were born. They waited to see how they turned out. And so consequently what happened is you had a whole lot of sons running around trying to be good sons. If you read, for instance, Caesar, Julius Caesar, didn't adopt any of his sons. He adopted his nephew, Octavius. Because Octavius had a better chance of ruling than his sons did. Of course, he had multiple wives of these sons or mothers of these sons, but he wasn't much of a father. But he adopts Octavius. And if you look at the ancient world, study history, you see all these people who are adopted who become the sons. I'll give you a good example. In writing, you've got Ben-Hur. You know the story of Ben-Hur? Ben-Hur? Everybody got Ben-Hur, right? Okay, so what happens is Ben-Hur's on a galley ship. He's been sentenced to a life on a galley as a galley slave because his sister Tirzah accidentally pushes a big stone off of a roof and it hits the head of a soldier who dies. And so he gets hauled off into captivity and he's going to pay the price for his sister. And he's on a galley ship and they're out fighting the Parthians and they're getting beat up. Well, when the ship begins to come apart, the slaves all get loose and they escape. The general who is in charge of the troops on this ship is so heavily laden with armor that he can't swim. He goes down. And Ben-Hur, because he's a man righteous in his heart, jumps into the water, and this is a movie, you understand this. He jumps into the water, and he brings this guy back up from the surface, grabs onto some flotsam and jetsam, whatever they call it, you know, if it was floating around, and holds him until the Romans can come and save him. They go back to Rome, and of course the guy is a proconsul. He's a very wise and important man, big family, whatever, and he adopts Ben-Hur. He adopts him. So Ben-Hur now goes back to the Palestine looking for his mother and sister. And he runs into Stephen Boyd. Remember Stephen Boyd? Stephen Boyd was a guy named Sulla. He and Sulla were boyhood friends, and they used to chum it around. But as they grew older, and the Roman and the Jew had this kind of thing, they developed this evil, combative relationship. And Sulla was the one who had sent him off into captivity. So he comes to town, and Sulla can't do anything about it because he outranks him. He's been adopted by this other guy. So that's just an example of adoption and how it works. Now, when Jesus is ministering, little kids are attracted to him. Shouldn't surprise any of us, but it surprised the disciples. What happened is that in the ancient world, children were to be seen and not heard. Now, that was ancient world was like when I was a kid. That's what they used to tell us. But children would be seen and not heard. No father would expect to deal with his children, his sons, until they'd been bar mitzvahed. The mother would raise them and train them. The rabbis would train them. And until they came into the fellowship of the men at bar mitzvah, they would not come. They would not be accepted or received among the men. And they would not have received that. Jesus is resting from his labors, and these kids are coming around, and the disciples are going crazy, and they're pushing the kids away. They're pushing the kids away. Jesus says to the disciples, and in the Greek it says it really clearly, but it's translated in English, it says, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." Y'all have heard that, right? Suffer. The word means put up with the nuisance of having the children come to me. Allow the nuisance of having the children come unto me. And then he brings the children in and he says to them, unless you become like these children, you cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now he's not talking about they're bratty and they're selfish and they, oh that's right, they're not our kids. So anyway, he's talking about the fact that they have faith, that they trust, that they're gentle, that they're relatively innocent and all that sort of thing. He's saying, unless you become like these children, you cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Consequently, Christians develop a whole different attitude about children than any of the cultures before them. Now, when Christianity becomes a known or identified religion, it goes through a lot of persecution from time to time, and it has other times when it's kind of like tolerated and put up with. And one of the things that people said, Marcus Aurelius was an emperor. He's also an Epicurean philosopher. And he wrote a tract called About Crestus. And in this, it's translated. And in this he said, now Christianity is a barbarian religion. It's disgusting. Nobody ought to ever be a Christian. Because after all, they eat the body of their God. And secondly, they have a paucity of gods. They only have one God. You know, any good religious person is going to have dozens. But they only have one God, and they eat the body of their God. They're cannibalistic. And, he said, their leaderships are the most disgusting of people. They take leadership from women and slaves and barbarians, and they idolize their children. You know, they put their children up, you know, on pedestals. So his take on Christianity was that it was barbarian for all those reasons. So what happened is that in the world, in the Roman world, the Greek world, but in the Roman world in particular, which is the time frame I'm talking about, when a guy's girlfriend, wife, paramour, lover, somebody he knows comes to him and says, by the way, we're going to have a son, we're going to have a child, he has a decision. He's God. I mean, this is a patriarchal world. Be right there. Okay? He says, he has a decision. And that is whether or not to allow the child to live or not. And many, many times he'll say, take it to the Tiber and throw it in. Now, if you've ever lived on a farm, you know what a rain barrel's for when you got too many cats. And that's what they would do. They'd take the baby down and they would throw the baby into the Tiber. Well, most mothers didn't like that. And so what happened is that the Christians would meet these women sometimes down there and take the babies off their hands. And when it became known that the Christians would care for these children, then they would wake up one day and they would find these babies on their front doorsteps where they lived. That's how they became known as foundlings. Okay, go ahead. You were going to say?
Just a quick question back on Marcus Aurelius. What was the name of that writing?
It was called About Crestus. Chrestus. That's the English translation of it. I can put you onto some good books on all this if you want to read some of this. So at any rate, the whole thing about children is the love and devotion for children is a Christian thing. It wasn't always this way. My father will tell you, because he was one of 11, that he was pretty sure his grandfather, his father was operating under the same theory, that you know, children were for laborers and farmers and whatever. All right, comments on all this. I think I'm going to have to quit. I've gotten carried away as usual.
So, by what you're saying about the adoption, then Abraham giving up Isaac before God, did he have the love like we have for our children?
Abraham did. Abraham's relationship with Isaac is obviously one of great love and whatever, but it's atypical. And one of the reasons it is because he waited for so long. I mean, he couldn't have children, you know. And he actually, we're told, loved Ishmael. But as soon as it got to the place where there was conflict, potential conflict over Isaac, so that Isaac might have trouble managing, he got rid of the other sons. Ishmael he sent off ahead of time because his wife pushed him into it, didn't really want to. But the sons of Keturah he gave money to and sent them down the road so that they wouldn't give Isaac any trouble, the head of the tribe. Comments?
Well, with regard to that, I've always had to swallow that God would put Abraham to that test. If he did that today, they'd throw you in jail for being a sicko.
Yeah.
Psychologically damaging your child forever.
Yeah.
And yet, and of course, God sees the future, so he didn't have to do it for his benefit, supposedly, to see what Abraham would do. Maybe he wants to nail Abraham's brain to say, you really had to make the choice, so now it's locked and loaded in your head that you chose me over your own son. But it seems like a pretty hard.
We can't put our modern understandings and sensibilities on the Old Testament people and expect them to march to them for a lot of reasons. One is just plain the growth of culturization. The other is they're not Christian and they're not spirit-filled. Now, the book of Hebrews tells us that Abraham knew that God would raise Isaac from the dead. The book of Hebrews tells us that. That Abraham knew that he would because God had promised Abraham that the lineage would come through Isaac. So the book of Hebrews says that Abraham knew that if he killed Isaac, that God would raise him from the dead. And as far as the thing goes about the psychological damage, when you look at Isaac, you don't see a lot of psychological damage. Isaac's one of the most easygoing people in the world, and in fact, he's too easygoing, and he doesn't seem to have. He's kind of a big mama's boy. You know, he has to have somebody go get a wife for him. He's not, can't go get his own. Unlike Jacob, for instance. You know. So, yeah. Other comments? Well, we'll take up with the conversion of King Nebuchadnezzar next time. And keep trying to move through some of this pre-prophetic stuff. Somebody pray us out.